A very short poem, you'll probably think it's awful, but if you eat around the outside, you'll have a hashtag waffle.
Next up, we have Donald Maloney.
I'm going to read a short section of a short story I've been reading. Still a work in progress, so I'm not sure. So, if you haven't heard any of the rest of it, I assure you that it is a story, it's just us random thoughts. You might see anything strange. I'll just read a very short section. Early during my stay in Cork, I went to a folk recital where, accompanied by a harpist, a singer encanted old Irish songs in a quavering voice. With her lush red hair, embroidered dress, and expressively shut eyelids, she looked the part, and my fellow foreign students were enraptured. But I couldn't help wanting to experience some neutral rendition of the song without the singer's interpretation of the past. That's how I understood the closed eyes and the vibrato anyway, as a privilege reaching into the past to bring back some message, as if she were a shaman or a clairvoyant. I learned how to read music in school, and I wondered what the sheet music looked like. When was the music written down first? It's not that I doubted the singer's sincerity, just that I couldn't see how she could reach any distance into the past with any certainty. Ultimately, I suppose, I wanted her to proceed more like a scientist. And sure enough, when I foolishly expressed my reservations to my fellow foreigners afterwards, I was dismissed as an engineer. In my enumeration earlier of German composers, I left out Wagner. And yet I liked the Tannhäuser Overture before I found out how dispiritingly bad his anti-Semitism was. And I should also mention that when I read about his attack on Mendelssohn, my gut response was partisan. When I tell you that I had no appetite for untangling Wagner's genius from the bombast and overheated mythological fantasies, it is precisely that, a matter of appetite, taste, and distaste. I make no claims to aesthetic objectivity. But I'll say this, his attack on Jews in music was conniving and hateful. And although I'm as happy as anyone else to forgive great minds all kinds of great faults, I don't really want my geniuses to be conniving and hateful.
Next we have Mary O'Connell.
To do this up until now because the summer has come, which is good. It's called A Sonnet for Summer. The wild abandon of a brown-limbed child, drenched in the radiance of summer's past, is tanned, grown older. She is less beguiled by certain scenes she always thought would last. Those hills of heather and fierce blazing gorse topped a drowsy quilt of tiny fields. The tar that slowly bakes beneath the force of unrelenting rays and then congeals. Honeysuckle spilling from a crumbling wall, an evening thick with insect-curdled air. The scent of petals as they slowly fall, waves chivied by the lightship's sweeping glare. There's nothing in the present to outshine the salt-washed splendor of that halcyon time.
Thank you, Mary. Next we have,
managed to sleep in it.
We have the third and a half poet is Cathal Bowden.
Hi, so I'm going to do a little poem that has a working title, but it's pretty much done. It's called The World Tree. I did it here the last time, so forgive me. They say Brahm made the Yoni and the Linga. Between them they made the world. They say ice melted Brahm the cosmic giant. They say that Yahweh breathed the world. And some unnamed the mystery, the great and silent how. But something came out of the nothing, and it came from then to now. So there is wholeness in every schism, fractured vision, cosmic soul. The spider's eyes that read the wise of every thread within the web that holds the whole. So come see a disconnected trigger switch that's floating out in space, and it's just trying to find a powder keg and make a circuit out the trace, and take it dancing with the centerpiece, with the oracle divined, because she shake and twitch to make the shift and stitch her wavelengths to your mind. Now it's a droplet with a galaxy suspended in its dome. It's just phasing through realities and trying to find a home, because all these sim city simians seem simple and complete, but their simplicity is a symptom of their simulated streets. Now there's a peregrine with talons out and rabbits down below. There were kids out fetching water when they got lit by the drone. Now we're in a Baghdad courtyard where the gentlemen play chess. Cut and fade to Brooklyn cyborg, hip-hop soundtrack even in dress. And yes, the gods, they walk among us as a record starts to spin in the RPM of Saturn with a needle on the rim. And he's a little bronchioli trying to pump the cosmic lung. But he's been flowing out of rhythm and the oxygen won't come. Now he's writing on the bedsheets while you whisper in her ear for the bliss in this existence comes because it all can disappear. And now we're snugly nestled in the Buddha's frontal lobes, thrumming in the essence with the radiance of Om as the current pulls us deeper, sparkle tingle on the tongue, a transcendental prism held against the silver setting sun. And here sits Shiva on a stairwell with the chillum and the cross. Sometimes he prays to Christian angels because it's Vishnu's Krishna's tender flock. And now they shake cans of Montana, always stolen, never bought. And they sneak into the station, the graffiti trains of thought. And if you look close between the couplings, the truth is what you'll see. A pair of diamond cufflinks on a ragged pauper's sleeve. And now she floats above the cities, see them sparkling below. And she's reflected in the moon tides and sees the seeds the sea will sow. And yes, the pool comes from the goddess, who is known by many names. And she's kneeling in her garden where she's nurturing a flame. And she waters with devotion, and she nurses with her light. For someday his dance will burn the oceans and usher in the cosmic night. And they encompass the circumference, they encircle every sphere. For the bliss in this existence comes because it all can disappear. Thank you.
This next fellow, I have to tell you a story with him. There's a TV show on at 9:30 on RT one tomorrow night, How to Be Happy, and our next reader is a big part of that. And I think he's on the radio tomorrow as well, being interviewed by Ray Darcy. So put your hands together for Stanley Knott.
Thanks, Rob. Yeah, 10:30 tomorrow morning if you don't fuck all it's an hour to spill. Right, and back to the band, one thing I said last week, Caldwell, I wasn't quite playing games, but we got to finish during the week. So this is a poem constructed using Caldwell's song titles. Above the clouds, dreams of children drift off amongst butterflies. Early morning rain echoes round the sun, and a pink dragonfly, invisible on white walls, is waiting. All around the world, just like yesterday, the news of the world, rip up the pages, rip up the pages. Wake up the frightened nation with pity poor Alfie, a bullet for everyone. Everything has a price. At the foot of the mountain, mermaids crowd out of the sinking. Sea spray steams on golden sands, and heliocentric birds rise and fall above a coconut grove. In the city, heavy souls sitting in limbo return to driving nowhere back to work, and bitterness rising when arrival time, that promised land, leaves them wishing on a star. Around the lakes, golden leaves are falling from trees that sleep the sleep of the serene. Andromeda touch, the start of forever, and leafy mysteries call you to that spiritual feeling. Down in the tube station at midnight, a porcelain soul asks a man of great promise, "Have you made up your mind about my small personal fortune?" But porcelain gods like fortune cookies don't make promises, so David Watts circles into tomorrow thinking, "My whole world is tumbling down." Now it's night. One perfect, bright star circles the cosmos. He is the keeper of dreams, illumination, stand out from the universe. "This is the truth," he says, as you lean into the light. "Even in the modern world, when you call me, I want to make it all right." Thank you.
Thanks, Danny. Next, Richard Hawtrey.
This is a short sequence called Three Early Versicles. They're poems about a group of medieval saints. One is, the first is local, Colmorn of Cloyne. "I do not wake to a weak stanza after lush and dream-rich sleep. My verse is rest from a Lenten fast, grace distilled from Christ's own cast." The second is associated with Guflac of Croyland. "That is the turning of love's gates, when in our hearts she elevates those gifts of spirit. Even her master bids us drink, to think and let love sink right through, making our hinges new." And the last is called Fadenmore. "So up with you then, illuminated bird, singing a new psalm from soft Fadenmore. Your plumage stiffened with ink, your hooked beak riddled with peat. Beatus bearing, bog sway, struggling from the handmade word slick."
Thank you, Richard. Next we have Patricia Walsh.
Say where I am in the novel. The twins have just arrived on site and they're trying to work out what it is, but nobody is very forthcoming. Joan was at the end of his tether. "Now, for God's sake, Alison, what's the site that we're excavating in anyway? What is the date of it and why are we here?" Alison laughed. "You're talking dates, site types. I'm sorry, guy, but this is a gulag camp and this is year zero." "Year zero? Have you never heard of Pol Pot? When Cambodia in the 1970s, he tried to make a complete socialist revolution by making the intellectuals work themselves to death in the killing fields, if his soldiers did not finish them off first. I think that archaeology works on the same principle. Archaeology is communism, if you think you're dead. So that's why I can't get a straight answer about the place from anyone on the site." "Precisely. Just keep your head down and do what you're told. That's not fun." "Almost forgot," said Alison, rummaging in her rucksack, pulling out the radio. "This might keep us entertained, it's a shower radio." "Shower radio? What sort of invention is that?" "It's a radio you can use in the shower that is waterproof, but it won't sound when it starts to rain. Although burying it under a ton of spoil won't do it any favours. Apparently in North Korea, our people are not allowed to listen to anything apart from state broadcasts, and foreigners are not allowed to bring radios in with them to this country. So we'd have to rely on them being spoken from outside by way of parachute, let's know about the outside world." Gable sighed past, shaking his head in disapproval. "Sorry lads, you'll have to get rid of that. I don't approve of radios on site." "Why? We're doing okay with it, aren't we?" "It's a distraction. Now get rid of it by the time we get back." Alison shook her head disdainfully. See, she quipped. I can only use communism. What did I tell you? If you think you're dead. Sam mumbled by, and Alison could not have outside digging his experience fence. On the other hand, look at this boy, she said to the twins. Watch and learn. A lesson in communist politics. Hey there, Sam. Love the shape of our t-shirt. Did you ever read the motorcycle diaries? What's that, she said. I don't know. I'd ask Wheeler. She's a motorbiker, she'll know. You hear that? He's never been there, never done that, but he's wearing a t-shirt. The image of Che Guevara has now succumbed to commercialism. Well, at least he's not a champagne socialist. He loves his drink, though. Every evening he's reading on pub docks in Cassidy's and sinking pints there. He's in bar from every other pub on Valle Bastard. Thanks.
Next we have Charles Clark.
Okay. This is the third of a series, the last, connected with the London chapter of the Irish Jordan Society, which used to flourish greatly at one time under the leadership of a very distant relation of mine called Brian Leask. And therefore, one of these things, it had, there were parties, lectures, tours, and even fancy dress parties. At Chandler's house, he dresses up in Regency costume, and why not? A high collar gives a lift, belt through the hole, its folds, cut like pastry, have a surprising likeness. There is much to be said for the brown of the middle class, softening the outline. Ironing to get the shirt front right, the time well spent, what song builds, one thinks. So dressed, his forebears stepped into the studios of Cregan, Archer, Shea, or Hamper artists, posers of busts and draperies and other props. Tonight, speeding in a taxi to an evening do in a palazzo, he balances that world with the London of his attack.
Next, we have Pascal.
Coffee at Lafayette's Imperial Hotel, Friday the 21st of June 2013, the longest day, probably the longest title, but this morning of bright some sunny cheer, I'd like to thank Paddy Poe for the paper as well, I gave him enough money to buy readings of it, but this morning of bright some sunny cheer, set out by table, mind quite clear, in pensive thought I mused in pose, and tried to scribe a sheaf of prose. When crossed my path with look surprise, a male, well suited, with four eyes. Through those peepers he did peer down, and about his forehead appeared a frown, upon spying my pigs in sandal shoe, and holy socks with toes peering through. You'd need to stitch the worsted yarn from where your digits view the morn, quoth he, with southside voice tinged with shout, and sneering smile upon his snout. As he put down his paper views of portrayed, paginated news, then sat at table set nearby where cup and paper both did lie, sip then read and sip, their contained contents soon were lit. Toward this quaffer I turned and way, and these words to him did I essay, my worsted yarn I can change about, but you buy never your big loud mouth. And just a bit there on Wagner and just a part in. Finlandia gave us Sibelius, Hector Berlioz was a Frank, Mozart was pure genius, and Handel was a crank.
Next we have Quite. And next we have Niall Harriet.
Come here.
So, this being Bloom's Day, I thought I'd honor Mr. Joyce and Ulysses. A very long piece, like Ulysses. It's called The Cuckolding of Leopold Bloom by Blazes Boylan. And I trawled through the old five-word challenge pieces and came up with this one. Oh yes, the words were, now I think there was a bit of mischievousness in the room, because the words were, hello, tight, thingamajig, enter, and aphrodisiac. So, well, hello, Mr. Boylan. You are such an aphrodisiac. Yes, enter my tight thingamajig. Yes, Blazes, yes, yes. And the second one is the second one is Joyce on Big Bang. I'm just imagining Joyce writing this. Another five-word piece I had, which was words were celestial, bracelet, spanner, silence, and Jesus. And presumptuous bastard, aren't I? Joyce writing this. Anyway. First there was silence. Then celestial fireworks exploded in the void, set off by the grumpy big guy in the sky because he was lonely. Forget evolution and all that old bollocks. Jehovah formed a man out of clay, big gob. Then nicked back a rib, and behold, there was woman. That really put a spanner in the works, because Eve asked Adam for a bracelet in return for an apple she'd plucked from the tree of knowledge. And excuse me, going blind here. And the result was original sin. And ever since there's been lots of big bangs since then. Later on, the Almighty sacrificed his only son, Jesus Christ, known to us dubs as Jesus, to bring us to our senses. And if you believe all that, you'll believe anything.
I'd forgotten it was Bloom's Day. Anyway, next we have Jim.
This was a poem I wrote probably about 15 years ago for a competition to do with shoes. And it's a story of love, separation, foreign travel, betrayal, and so on. Okay. In days long gone past their sell-by date, it is recounted that a knight of noble birth, tall, handsome, and of formidable girth, did love a lady fair, with hair, in all the right places. But strange to say, this tale told dwells not upon her airs or graces, but more upon her shoes and laces. For as so often with man and his chattels, to defend them he has to go to fight battles. And thus it was in armor bright, our good knight set forth to fight the good fight. All he took with him from his dear true love was a dainty shoe, not a lock of hair, nor yet a silken glove. In distant land he pitched, his tent was pitched, and come the dark hand of night, our hero's shadow, projected on the tent, of a silhouetted cushion and small shoe was bent. And by way of transference, the shoe became the focus of his love and passion, as in days of now is all the fashion. Into this vessel of his desire, he poured his heart and all his pent-up things, and while asleep at night, the shoe took flight like the migrating swallow, or the kingly salmon returning it to its source. How did it do this, we may muse? Was it lack of a brain that failed to confuse? The shoe, perhaps, with help of stars and planets, or maybe a keen sense of smell, did navigate its way back to its other half. Anyway, our good knight did hitch a lift with the shoe, and in two ticks was in his lover's arms, and other places too. The shoes shuffled off, nuzzling each other fondly, to do what shoes do in private, and we can only wonder. But anyway, to cut a story long short, this old malarkey went on longer than it ought. For our good knight's performance in the field, his double-headed axe he could hardly wield. In fact, he was so well and truly shagged with all the late nights and the travel lag. Not only that, like most things in this life, his love began to cool and turn quite sour into a consistency not unlike thick yogurt. And doubts crept in his mind like furtive mice. Whose was that double-handed broadsword in the hall? The shoe also complained its other half had let itself go, that the shine had gone off their love. How much does a tin of polish cost, heavens above? Well, saith the knight with a sigh of resignation, at least we have each other as way of compensation. As a footnote, when the war was over, I'm afraid to tell, the knight and the shoe found that they were incompatible. The knight turned from one shoe to the next, looking always for the perfect shoe became his quest. As for the shoe, after a period of adjustment, became a counsellor on loss and bereavement.
Okay, thank you. And next we have Sarah.
This one is called Paul. He drove the line, traces boundary between it and the rest. Let it be born in its own right to be a field, a word, or a business. Each curve drives it further out of any control. Is it stealing its life, or is he the one giving it? Regardless, he pours in his all. The space soon will be closed. In there will hatch imagination. Yolk fused with the shell, out of which will grow feathers and fur of incarnation. Shall he add some shading? No, the darkness of this unbeing is his own. He sets it loose, its bewilderment stoked by a breath he released in a moan. A few turns and it's over. As it was here, the chimera is gone. For the artist has come to and draws a line again to summon the unknown.